every shelf clean of wine in the first week of occupation, forcing him into an unwelcome period of sobriety. "Very kind, Aspect," he said, "though I confess my surprise at your knowledge of such matters. You hear all manner of things as a healer. People will spill their deepest secrets to those they hope can take their pain away." She met his gaze, and there was a new weight to her voice when she added, "I really wouldn't linger too long in seeking out the wine, good sir." "I shan't, Aspect." The Free Sword rapped his keys against the door, voicing an impatient grunt. "I must go," he told her, taking the empty sack. "A pleasure as always, Aloysius." She held out a hand, and he knelt to kiss it, a courtly ritual they had adopted over the weeks. "Do you know," she said as he rose and went to the door, "I believe if Lord Darnell were truly a courageous man, he would have killed us by now." "Raising his own fief against him in the process," Lucius replied. "Even he is not so foolish." She nodded, smiling once again as the Free Sword closed the door, her final words faint, but still audible and insistent. "Be sure to enjoy the wine!" Lord Darnell sent for him in the afternoon, forestalling an exploration of the southern quarter. The Fief Lord had taken over the only surviving wing of the palace, a gleaming collection of marble walls and towers rising from the shattered ruin that surrounded it. The walls were partly covered in scaffolding as masons strove to remold the remnants into a convincingly self-contained building, as if it had always been this way. Darnell was keen to wipe away as much of the inconvenient past as possible. A small army of slaves labored continually in pursuit of the new owner's vision. The ruined wings cleared to make room for an ornamental garden, complete with looted statuary and as yet unblossomed flowerbeds. Aloysius was always surprised at his own lack of fear whenever he had the misfortune to find himself in the Fief Lord's presence. The man's temper was legendary, and his fondness for the death warrant made old King Janus seem the model of indulgent rule. However, for all his evident scorn and contempt, Darnell needed him alive, at least until father wins his war for him. He was admitted to the new throne room by two of Darnell's burlier knights, fully armoured and smelling quite dreadful, despite all the lavender oil with which they slathered themselves. As yet, it seemed no blacksmith had solved the perennial problem of the foul odours arising from prolonged wearing of armour. Darnell sat on his new throne, a finely carved symphony of oak and velvet, featuring an ornately decorated back that reached fully 7 feet high. Though yet to formally name himself king, Darnell had been quick to attire himself with as many royal trappings as possible, King Malsys's crown being chief among them, though Aloysius fancied it sat a bit too loose on his head. It shifted on his brow now as the Fief Lord leaned forward to address the man standing before him, a wiry and somewhat bedraggled fellow in the garb of a Valerian soldier, a black cloak about his shoulders. Aloysius's fear reasserted itself at the sight of the man standing behind the sailor. Division Commander Mervac stood tall and straight in his black enamel breastplate, heavy, scarred features impassive as always when in the Fief Lord's presence. Darnell might need him alive, but the Valerian certainly didn't. He took some heart from the sight of his father, standing with his arms crossed at Darnell's side. "A shark?" Lord Darnell said to the sailor, his voice heavy with scorn. "You lost your fleet to a shark?" The sailor stiffened, his face betraying a man suffering insult from one he considered little more than a favoured slave. "A red shark," the sailor replied in good but accented realm tongue, "commanded by an Elvera." "Elvera?" Darnell asked. "I thought this fabled Elvera was engaged in delaying General Tokriv at Altor." "It is not a name, at least not these days," Mervec explained. "It means witch or sorceress, born of an old legend." "I could give a horse cunt hair for your legend," Darnell snapped. "Why do you bring me this defeated dog with his wild tales of witches and sharks?" "I am no liar," the sailor retorted, face reddening. "I witnessed to 1,000 deaths or more at the hands of that bitch and her creature." "Control your dog," Darnell told the division commander quietly, "or he'll get a whipping as a lesson." The sailor bridled again, but said no more when Mervek placed a restraining hand on his shoulder, murmuring something in his own language. Aloysius's Valerian was poor, but he was sure he detected the word patience in the commander's soothing tone. "Ah, little poet," Darnell said, noticing Aloysius. "Here's one worthy of a verse or two. The great Valerian fleet sunk by a dark-blessed shark, answering the whim of a witch." "Elvera," the sailor said again before adding something in his own language. "What did he say?" Darnell asked the division commander in a weary tone. "Born of fire," the commander translated. "The sailors say the witch was born of fire because of her burns."
"Burns?"
"Her face." The sailor played a hand over his own features. "Burned, vile to look upon. A creature, not a woman." "And I thought you people were absent all superstition," Darnell said before turning back to Aloysius. "What do you imagine this means for our great enterprise, little poet?"
"It would seem the Maldinian Islands did not fall so easily after all, my lord," Aloysius replied in a flat tone. He saw his father shift at Darnell's side, catching his eye with a warning glare. However, Darnell seemed untroubled by the observation.
"Quite so. Despite the many promises made by our allies, they fail to secure me the isles and instead bring dogs into my home barking nonsense."
He pointed a steady finger at the sailor.
"Get him out of here," he told Mervek. "Come forward, little poet." Darnell beckoned him with a languid wave when the Valerians had made their exit. "I'd have your views on another tall tale."
Aloysius strode forward and went to one knee before the throne. He was continually tempted to abandon all pretense of respect, but knew the Lord's tolerance had its limits, regardless of his usefulness.
"Here."
Darnell picked up a spherical object lying at the foot of his throne and tossed it to Aloysius. "Familiar, is it not?" Aloysius caught the item and turned it over in his hands. A Renfalen knight's helmet, enameled in blue, with several dents and a broken visor.
"Lord Wenders," he said, recalling that Darnell had made his chief lapdog a gift of an unwanted suit of armour.
"Indeed,"
Darnell said.
"Found 4 days ago with a crossbow bolt through his eye. I assume you have little trouble guessing the origin of his demise."
"The Red Brother."
Aloysius concealed his grin.
"Burned the Earlish to nothing, and still you couldn't get him."
"Yes," Darnell said. "Curious thing. They tended his wounds before they killed him. What's even more curious is the tale told by the only survivor of his company. He didn't last very long, I'm afraid, victim of a crushed and festered arm. But he swore to the departed that the entire company had been buried in a rock slide called forth by the Red Brother's fat master."
"Graylin?"
Aloysius kept all expression from his face as he asked.
"Called forth, my lord?"
"Yes. With the Dark, if you can believe it. First the tale of the Dark-afflicted brother, now the ballad of the witch's shark. All very strange, wouldn't you agree?"
"I would, my lord. Most certainly."
Darnell reclined in his throne, regarding Aloysius with arch scrutiny.
"Tell me, in all your dealings with our cherished surviving aspects, did they ever make mention of this fat master and his dark gifts?"
"Aspect Dendrish asks for books and food. Aspect Alera asks for nothing. They make no mention of this master..."
Darnell glanced at Aloysius's father.
"Graylin, my lord,"
Lacryl Alhestian said.
"Yes, Graylin."
Darnell returned his gaze to Aloysius.
"Graylin."
"I recall the name, my lord. I believe Lord Alsorna made mention of him during our time together in the Usurper's Revolt. He minded the Sixth Order stores, I believe."
Darnell's face lost all expression, draining of colour, as it often did at mention of the name Alsorna, something Aloysius knew well and counted on to provide suitable distraction from further astute questioning. Today, however, the fief lord was not so easily diverted.
"Store-minder or no," he grated after a moment, "it now seems he's a pile of ash."
He pulled something from the pocket of his silk robe and tossed it to Aloysius. A medallion on a chain of plain metal, charred but intact. the blind warrior.
Your father's scouts found this amongst the ashes in a pyre near Wenda's body. It's either the Fat Masters or the Red Brothers, and I doubt we'd ever get that lucky.
No, Aloysius agreed silently. You never would.
Our Valerian allies are extremely interested in any whisper of the dark, Darnell told him, paying huge sums for slaves rumored to be afflicted with it. Imagine what they'll do to your friends in the Blackhold, if they suspect they have knowledge of more. The next time you visit them, show them this medallion. Tell them this tall tale, and report back to me every word they say. He got to his feet, walking towards Aloysius with a slow gait, face quivering a little now, lips wet with spittle. They were roughly of equal height, but Darnell was considerably broader and a seasoned killer. Somehow, though, Aloysius still felt no fear as he loomed closer.
"This farce has dragged on long enough," the fieflord rasped. "I ride forth tonight with every knight in my command to hunt down the Red Brother and secure my son. Whilst I'm gone, you will make sure those sanctimonious shits know I'll happily hand them over to our allies to see them flayed, skinless, if it'll drag their secrets forth, aspects or no."
Chapter 3. Frentis. She wakes, her eyes finding a dim yellow glow in a world of shadow. The glow resolves into the flame of a single candle, not so clear as it should be. For a moment, she wonders if she has been reborn into a half-blind body. The allies' joke, or further punishment. But then she recalls that her sight, her first body's sight, had always been unusually sharp. "Keener than any hawk," her father had said centuries ago, a rare compliment that had brought tears to her eyes then, but brings nothing to these now. These weaker, stolen eyes. She lies on hard stone, cold and rough on her naked skin. She sits and something moves in the gloom, a man stepping from the shadow into the meager light. He wears the uniform of the Council Guard, and the lean face of a veteran, but she sees his true face in the leer of his shaded eyes.
"How do you find it?" he asks her.
She raises her hands, flexing the fingers and wrists. Strong, good. Her arms are lean, well-sculpted, similarly her legs lithe and supple.
"A dancer?"
she asks the Council Guard.
"No.
She was found when young. The northern hill tribes, richer and gifted than elsewhere in the Empire. The gift is powerful, an uncanny way with the wind. Something I'm sure you'll find a use for. She was trained with knife, sword, and bow from the age of 6, security against your inevitable fall." She feels a faint anger at this. It was not inevitable, any more than love is inevitable. She is tempted to let the anger build, fuel her new body with rage, and test its abilities on the leering messenger, but is given pause by another sensation. The music flows. The tune is fierce and strong. Her song is returned. She finds a laugh bubbling in her breast and lets it out. Her head thrown back, the sound exultant as another thought comes to her, no less fierce in its joyful realization. "I know you see me, beloved." He came awake with a start, raising a curious whine from Slasher, who had been sleeping at his feet. Next to him, Master Renziel slept on, an oddly serene smile on his face, a man content in slumber. Apart from battle, it was the only time he appeared sane. Frentis sat up with a groan, shaking his head to clear the dream.
"Dream? Do you really believe that's what it was?"
He pushed the thought away and pulled on his boots, hefting his sword and exiting the small tent he shared with the master. The sky was still dark, and he judged it no more than 2 hours into the new day by the moon's height. Around him, the company lay sleeping. The tents provided by Baron Banders a wondrous luxury after so many days of hardship. They were encamped on the southern slope of a tall hill, one of the downs that made the Renfalen border country so distinct.
campfires forbidden by the Baron, who saw no reason to give Lord Darnell an indication of their numbers.
6,000 men, Frontis thought, his eyes surveying the camp, recalling the intelligence provided by the unfortunate Lord Wenders. Enough to take a city held by Darnell's knights and a full division of Valyrians?
A soft sound drew his attention back to the tents where his company slept. A soft giggle rising from the tent Arundel shared with Lady Ilion. He heard faint but urgent whispers followed by more giggles.
I should stop this, he decided, starting forward, then paused as the words Ilion had spoken the day before came back to him. I am not a child. They lost their youth in my bloody crusade, he thought, with worse to come at Varenshold. He sighed and moved away until the sounds grew faint. It was a half moon tonight, but the sky was clear, providing enough light for a good view of the low country beyond the downs, so far free of any enemy.
Will he wait? Frontis wondered.
When Darnell hears that Banders has raised his fief against him, and now harbours his son, will he come?
His hand ached as he gripped his sword hilt, the bloodlust surging again, calling her voice as it always did.
Not so free of its delights after all, beloved?
Leave me be, he whispered in Valyrian, teeth gritted, forcing his hand to release the sword.
Learned a new language, then, brother?
Frontis turned to find a brother about his own age approaching from the shadows, tall with a narrow, handsome face and a lopsided grin. It was the grin that stirred his memory.
Ivan, he said after a moment.
The young brother halted a few feet away, eyes tracking Frentice from head to foot in blank wonder.
I thought Brother Solace was playing a joke when he told me, he said. But when does he joke about anything?
He came forward, arms encircling Frentice in a warm embrace.
The order, Frentice began when Ivan moved back. The house has fallen. There are no others.
I know.
He told me your tale. Little over 100 of us. All that remains of the Sixth Order.
Aspect Arlin lives. Darnell's lick spittle confirmed it, though he couldn't tell us where in Varenshold they imprisoned him.
A mystery to be solved when we get there. Ivern inclined his head at the cluster of tents nearby. I've half a bottle of Brother's Friend left, if you care to share.
Frentice had never been particularly partial to the Order's favourite tipple, disliking the way it dulled his senses, so he confined himself to a polite sip before handing the flask back to Ivern, who seemed to have no such concerns.
I tell the unvarnished and complete truth, he insisted after a healthy gulp from the flask.
She kissed me,
full on the lips.
Princess Lerna kissed you? Frentice inquired with a raised eyebrow.
Indeed she did. After a perilous, and dare I say, now legendary quest through the Lonak Dominion, I was halfway through writing it all down for inclusion in Brother Canis's archive when news of the invasion came.
His grin became rueful.
My finest hour as a brother. Lost to history thanks to larger concerns.
He met Frentice's gaze.
We heard a lot about you on the way south. The tale of the Red Brother flew fast and wide. There's even a version that says you saw her die.
The fire licked at her face as she screamed, her hair blackening as she beat the flames with her hands.
I didn't see her die, he said.
I just killed her, brother.
He had given a full accounting to Brother Solace the previous evening, whilst his company ate their first real meal in days, some so slumped in relief they couldn't raise the food to their mouths. Solace had absorbed every word without comment, his pale-eyed gaze betraying nothing as the epic of murder and pain ran its course. When it was done, like Aspect Greelin, he gave strict instructions not to repeat the tale to anyone and maintain the same fiction believed by the people who followed him.
The same lie, the woman's voice added in faint mockery.
So there's a chance, Ivan pressed. She could still be alive. I ask the departed every day to make it so.
Ivan took another drink.
The Lonak didn't understand what a princess was.
So called her a queen.
Turns out they were right. If I were a Valyrian, I'd be praying for her death. I wouldn't want to be in the eye of that woman's vengeance.
Vengeance, Frentice thought, looking down at his hands, hands that had snapped the neck of a king. Or justice. He returned to his company in the morning, finding Devoka in conversation with Ilion, the young highborn sitting rigid and pale of face as the Lonak spoke in instructional tones.
"You must be careful," she cautioned, working a stone along her spear blade. "Swollen belly no good in battle. Make sure he spends on your thigh."
When Ilion caught sight of Frentis, her face turned an immediate shade of scarlet. She stood up, walking away with a stiff but rapid gait, managing only a faint squeak in response to his greeting.
"Such things are not discussed openly among the Merim-Her," Frentis told a puzzled Devoka, sitting down beside her.
"Girl is foolish," she muttered with a shrug.
"Too quick to anger, too quick to part her legs. My first husband had to give 3 ponies before I lay a hand on him."
Frentis was tempted to ask how many ponies Ermund would be required to hand over in due course, but decided it would be an unwise question. Bound as he was by his oath, the knight had been quickly reinstated at Baron Banda's side, and they would sorely miss his sword. Devoka, however, seemed unperturbed by his sudden absence from their company, and Frentis wondered if he hadn't been anything more than a welcome diversion during the infrequent quiet days in the Erlish.
"Things are different here," he said, more to himself than her.
Ilion transformed from a pampered girl into a deadly huntress. Draker from an outlaw into a soldier. Graylin from a master to an aspect.
"Everything is different. The Valerians have built us a new realm."
Brother Commander Solis arrived as they were eating breakfast, favouring Devoka with a respectful nod, pausing only slightly at the sight of 34, who smiled back with a gracious bow.
"Baron Banders holds council," Solis told Frentis. "Your words are wanted." 500 knights and a piss-pot full of Valerians, eh?"
Baron Banders raised a bushy eyebrow at Frentis, voicing a small laugh.
"Hardly a mighty army, brother."
"If this Wenders spoke truly," Solis commented. The Baron held his council in a field away from the main camp, the various captains and lords of his army standing in a circle with scant ceremony or formal introduction. It seemed Banders had little use for the often elaborate manners of the Renfalen nobility.
"Wenders did not strike me as a man with enough wit for deception, brother," Frentis told Solis before turning to Banders.
"There are upwards of 8,000 men in the Valerian division, my lord. Plus they have the freesword mercenaries who guard the slavers and contingents of Curatai. I caution you not to underestimate them."
"Worse than the Apirans, are they?"
"In some ways." The Baron grunted and raised an eyebrow at Ermund, who gave a solemn nod.
"We killed many in the forest, my lord, but it cost us dear. If they have more, taking the city will be a bloody business."
"If Darnell is wise enough to stay behind his walls," Banders mused, "and wisdom is not one of his virtues."
"He has recruited wisdom," Frentis said. "Wenders told us Larkil Alhestian has been pressed into service as Darnell's battle lord. He'll know full well the value of not taking to open field against us."
"Blood rose," Banders said softly. "Couldn't abide the man, truth be told. But he never struck me as a traitor.
Darnell holds Alhestian's son as hostage to his loyalty. We should regard him an enemy, and not one given to misjudgments."
"Couldn't old Marbellus, though?"
Banders glanced at Solis. "Could he, brother?"
There was a slight pause before Solis replied, and Frentis wondered what horrors crowded his memory.
"No one could have held Marbellus, my lord," he said. "A pebble can't stand against an ocean."
Banders fell silent, his hand on his chin.
"Was hoping the Erlish would mask our advance," he said in a reflective tone. "At least for a time, providing timber for ladders and engines into the bargain. Now even that is taken from us."
"There are other ways, grandfather," Arundel spoke up. His mother, the Lady Ulis, stood at his side with a tight grip on his arm. Her relief at finding him alive the day before had been a spectacle of tearful kisses, though she had plainly been chagrined by her son's insistence on staying with Frentis's company.
"The good brother," Arundel said, gesturing to Frentis. "Devoka and I made our escape via the city's sewers. If we can get out, surely we can get in the same way."
The harbour pipe is too easily seen by their sailors, Frentis said. But there are alternatives, and one in our company who knows the sewers near as well as I.
I've 4,000 knights who won't fit so easily in a dungpipe, brother, Banders pointed out. Take their horses away, and they're as much use as a gelding in a whorehouse. The rest are men-at-arms, and a few hundred peasants with grudges to settle against Arnell and his dogs.
I have over 100 brothers, Solis said. Plus Brother Francis's company. Surely sufficient strength to seize a gate and hold it long enough to allow your knights entry.
And then what? Banders asked.
Street fighting is hardly within their experience, brother.
I'll fight in a bog, Ermin said. If it'll bring Darnell within reach of my sword.
Do not mistake the temper of your knights, my lord. Their course was not chosen lightly, and they'll follow you to the beyond and back if you command it.
I don't doubt their temper, Ermin, Banders assured him. But our fief lost enough wars to learn the lesson that a charging wall of steel cannot win every battle. And supposing we do manage to take the city, the bulk of the enemy's strength is still besieging Altor. And when they're finished, where do you suppose they'll march next?
From what little intelligence we can gather, Solis said, Fief Lord Muster has held out far longer than expected. Winter will be closing in by the time the Valerians take his capital and subdue his fief. Long enough for us to entrench, gather strength from Nilsale and the Reaches.
At mention of the Reaches, Banders turned to one of his captains, a veteran knight in white enameled armour.
No word, I take it, Lord Firrell?
It's a long ride to Meanshall, the knight replied, and a longer voyage to the Reaches. Our messengers were sent only 10 days ago.
I had hoped he'd be on the move by now,
Banders mused, and Frentis had no need to hear the name in the forefront of his mind.
He is, he said. I know it.
He looked at Brother Solis, who replied with a nod. And having Varianshold in our hands by the time he arrives will make our task much easier.
You ask me to risk much on the basis of faith alone, brother, Banders replied.
Faith, Frentis replied, is my business, my lord.
The Baron's army was well supplied with horses, most taken from the estates of knights who had sided with Darnell. They were all stallions, impressively tall at the shoulder, with the restlessness of horses bred to the charge. Master Renciel wandered the temporary paddock, where the horses were corralled, seemingly unaware of their snorts and whinnies, as he played his hands over flanks and neck, his expression the concentrated stare of the expert.
Not so...
Devoka fumbled for the right word as they watched the master go about his work.
Arakamin. Head sickness.
Mad, Frentis said, seeing the surety with which Master Renciel moved.
Not so mad when he's with horses, I know.
He looks on you and sees a son, Devoka said.
You know this too?
He sees many things, most of which are not there.
The master chose a horse for each of them, leading a youthful grey to Frentis and a broad black charger to Devoka.
Too big, she said, moving back a little as the great horse sniffed her.
No ponies here?
No, Master Renciel told her simply, and walked off to select more mounts.
You'll get used to him,
Frentis assured her, scratching the grey's nose.
Wonder what name you'll earn.
Merim Hur, Devoka muttered in derision.
People are named. Horses used and eaten.
They rode south at midday, Brother Solis scouting ahead with his brothers, the knights and retainers following in a tight column. At the Baron's order, every man was armoured and ready for battle. The peasant rebels followed behind on foot, mostly hardy-looking men, with little armour but a rich variety of weapons. There was a grim uniformity to their expression that Frentis knew well. The faces of the wronged and the angry. From the stories Ivan had told him of the brothers' journey from the pass, it was clear that shorn of the crown's authority, Darnell had lost little time in settling long-nurtured grievances, much of his ire falling on the common folk who worked the lands of his enemies. Frentis's company, few of whom could be called expert riders, made up the rear guard, strung out in a loose formation many had difficulty maintaining for long.
I fucking hate horses!
Draker huffed as he bounced along on the back of the russet-coated stallion Renciel had chosen for him.
"It's easy," Ilion told him, spurring on ahead, moving in the saddle with accustomed ease. "Just raise yourself up a little at the right moment." She laughed as Draco made a less than perfect attempt to comply, thumping himself onto the saddle with a hard grunt.
"Oh, my unborn children!"
Next to Frentis and Master Renciel, Arundel and Ilion were easily his best riders. He sent Arundel west and Ilion east with instructions to scout the flanks, and strict orders to return on seeing any sign of friend or foe. Lady Ulis had betrayed a clear unhappiness at sending Arundel out of her sight once again, but confined her objections to a stern scowl. She had joined them as they were forming up, offering few words beyond a statement that she would be travelling with her son by order of the Baron, though she did seem heartened by the presence of Devoka. "I know I owe you his life," she told the Lonak woman. "Whatever you require by way of thanks."
"Arundel is Gorin to me,"
Devoka told her shortly, adding when the lady frowned in incomprehension, "Clan." Devoka held her arm out and swept it around their company, from Frentis to 34 and Draker still wincing with every jolt of his saddle. "My clan. Burnt Forest Clan." She barked a laugh.
"Now yours."
"You could go home now," Ulis told her. "The north is clear all the way to the mountains."
Devoka's expression darkened, as if she had been insulted, but softened when she saw the woman's honest curiosity.
"Queen is not found," Devoka said. "No home for me until she is."
They entered the rougher hill country by late evening, banners acceding to Solis's choice of campsite. The north-facing slope of a promontory offering clear views in all directions and shielded on the southern side by a deep ravine. Fires were permitted now, Banders knowing full well further attempts at concealing such a large force would be redundant this far into Australian territory. Frentis's company were given the eastern flank to guard, and he posted pickets in a tight line, pairs of fighters standing 3-hour shifts. Ilion returned as he was touring the perimeter. "You stayed out too long," he told her. "Arundel got in an hour ago. Be back before nightfall in future." "Sorry, brother," she replied, avoiding his gaze, and he realized her embarrassment from this morning still lingered.
"Anything to report?" he asked in a less severe tone.
"Not another soul for miles around," she replied, brightening a little. "Except for a wolf 10 miles back. I've never seen one so big, I must say. Nor so bold. Just sat there looking at me for what seemed an age." "Probably smelling the blood to come," Frentis thought.
"Good. Get some rest, my lady."
He completed his tour of the pickets, finding the remaining fighters in a resilient mood. Now the terrors of their flight from the forest were over, they were as combative as ever, many voicing an eagerness to get to Varenshold.
"The scales haven't shifted yet, brother," former City Guard Corporal Vinton told him, the slightly wild gleam in his eye provoking memories of General Norrin. "Far too much blood weighing on our side. We'll balance them at Varenshold or die trying."
He returned to the main camp, sharing a meal with those still awake. 34 had taken on much of the cooking duties these days, producing a tasty stew of freshly caught partridge and wild mushrooms that put Arundel's amateur efforts to shame.
"They teached you cooking as well as torturing, then?"
Draker asked him between mouthfuls, the grease beading his beard as he chewed.
"My last master's cook slave fell ill during the voyage here,"
34 replied in his now eerily accentless realm tongue. "He was required to teach me his skills before he died. I have always been able to learn quickly." Lady Ulis accepted a bowl of stew from the former slave, her expression cautious.
"Torturing?" she asked.
"I was a numbered slave,"
34 replied in his precise, uncoloured tones. "A specialist, schooled in the arts of torture from childhood." He continued to ladle out the stew as the lady stared at him, her gaze slowly tracking across the faces around the fire. Frentis knew she was seeing them, truly, for the first time. The brutality that had shaped them, now plain in the hard set of Draker's eyes, Ilion's frowning concentration as she tightened the string on her crossbow, and the preoccupied cast in Arundel's eyes as he stared into the fire, spooning stew into his mouth with automatic and unconscious regularity. It was a hard road, my lady, Frances told her. Hard choices had to be made. She looked at her son, reaching over to smooth the hair back from his forehead, drawing a tired smile. I am not a lady, she said. If we are to be clanmates, you should know that. I am the unacknowledged bastard daughter to Baron Banders, nothing more. My name is just Ulis. No, Arundel stated, casting a hard glare around the fire. My mother's name is Lady Ulis, and any calling her by a different name will answer to me. Quite so, my lord, Frentis told him. Quite so. He busied himself with cleaning his weapons, long after the others had taken to their tents, the familiar drone of Draker's snores drifting across the camp. When his sword and knife were gleaming, he cleaned his boots, then his saddle, then unstrung his bow, and checked the stave for cracks. After that he sat and sharpened every arrowhead in his quiver. I do not need to sleep, he told himself continually, though his hands were beginning to tingle with exhaustion, and his head constantly slumped unbidden to his chest. Just dreams. He tried to force conviction into the thought, casting a reluctant gaze at his tent. Just the stain of her company, the stink of her in my mind. Just dreams. She does not see me. He finally surrendered when his fatigued hands left him with the bleeding thumb, returning the arrows to his quiver and walking to the tent on weak legs. Just dreams. She stands atop a tall tower, Volar spread out beneath her in all its ancient glory, street after street of tenements, marble mansions, gardens of wondrous construction, and myriad towers rising from every quarter, though none so tall as this one, the Council Tower. She raises her gaze to the sky, seeking a target. The day is clear, the sky mostly unbroken blue, but she spies a small cloud some miles above, thin and wispy, but sufficient for her purposes. She searches inside herself for the gift, finding she has to suppress her song to call it forth. But when it does, the power of it staggers her, making her reach for the parapet as she sways. She feels a familiar trickle from her nose, and understands the price for this one will be harder to bear even than the wonderful fire she stole from Revek. His words returning now with precise irony. Always the way with stolen gifts, don't you find? What did he know, she thinks. Though the scorn is forced and hollow, he knew enough not to be blinded by love. She forces unwelcome thoughts from her head and focuses on the cloud, the gift surging, more blood flowing from her nose as she releases it. The small cloud swirling into a tight vortex before flying apart, tendrils fading in the clear blue sky. Impressive. She turns to see a tall man in a red robe emerge from the stairway onto the tower roof. Two Kuratai follow him into the light, hands resting on their swords. She has yet to test the skill offered by this new shell, and has to resist the urge to do so now. Hide an advantage, and you double its value. One of her father's axioms, though she suspects he may have stolen it from a long-dead philosopher. Arcliff! She greets the tall man as he moves to her side. She can see a change in him, a new weariness around his eyes, an expression she knows well. He grieves. The messenger did not linger, he tells her. Safe to say that the Allies' guidance will now be spoken only by you. The Allies' guidance? As if he could comprehend the true meaning of those words, what it means to a soul in the void to hear the Allies' voice. She almost laughs at the ignorance of this ancient little man. Centuries of life, and still he knows nothing. He is staring at her in expectation, a faint concern on his brow, and she realizes it has been several moments since he spoke. How long had she been standing here? How long since she climbed the tower? She breathes deeply and allows the confusion to fade. You're grieving, she tells him. Who did you lose? He draws back a little, concern deepening into fear, no doubt wondering how much she already knew. she was learning the appearance of omniscience could offer as much power as omniscience itself.
"My son," Arcliffe says. "His vessel never reached Varenshold. The scryers can no longer find a trace of him in times to come." She nods, and waits for him to say more, but the councilman fixes a mask on his face and stays silent. "The ally wishes you to elevate me to council," she tells him. "The slaver's seat."
"That is Councilman Lorvec's seat," he protests. "One he has discharged with care and diligence for near a century, lining his pockets and failing to breed enough gifted in the process. The ally feels his guidance has not been fully appreciated, and with our new assets coming to maturity, he feels I would offer a more trustworthy overseer for this very particular enterprise. If Lorvec won't step down, I am sure ample evidence of corruption will be found to justify a charge of treason, unless you prefer a quieter method." He says more, but she doesn't hear him, feeling time slip away once more. How long has she stood here? When the confusion fades, she is alone again, and the sky is a darker shade of blue. She turns her sight to the west, tracking the broad estuary to the coast and the ocean beyond. "Please hurry to me, beloved. I am so very lonely." Chapter 4. Reva. She had seen enough corpses to know the dead rarely retained expression. The rictus smiles and fear-filled grimaces, merely the tightening of sinew and muscle as the body's humours drained away. So it was a surprise to find the priest's face such a picture of serenity. But for the deep, narrow cut in his throat, he could easily have been mistaken for a slumbering man, his features betraying a soul content with the world. "Content," she thought, moving back from the corpse to rest on her haunches. How fitting he should only find peace in death.
"This is him?" Velen asked.
She nodded, and rose as Alonis came to her side, touching a hand in reassurance. Velen held up his sister's sketch, eyes switching from the priest's face to the rendering on the parchment.
"What a talent you have,"
he told her, with a smile before turning to the hulking man standing near the tent wall.
"And you, Master Markin, quite the eye for detail."
Markin's beard constricted with a brief smile, and Reva noted how tightly his hands were gripped together, and his staunch refusal even to look at the second corpse. It lay alongside the priest, the features more typical of Reva's experience, the skin a pale blue, the lips drawn back and the tongue protruding from the bared teeth, part severed by his death rattle. However, as with the priest, his features were sufficiently recognizable to match Alornis's sketch. "Uncle Sentis said his name was Lord Brador," she told Velen. "Lady Velis tells me he owned land a little east of here, good vines, more renowned for white than red."
"That's all?" Velen asked. "No suspicions? Tall tales of strange powers or unexplained events?"
"That's all. Just a minor noble with a few hundred acres of grapes. And a barn." Velen looked expectantly at Markin. The big man gritted his teeth for a moment, then pointed a thick finger at Lord Brador's corpse, still refusing to look at it.
"This one I'll not touch, my lord. I can feel it, seeping out of him like poison. Forgive my cowardice, but—"
He shook his shaggy head.
I can't.
"It's all right, Markin," Velen assured him, nodding at the priest.
"And him?"
Markin huffed a relieved sigh and turned to crouch beside the priest, rolling up his sleeve and placing a meaty hand on the corpse's forehead. After a moment he winced as if in pain, his mouth twisting in disgust, as it seemed he was about to draw his hand away, but she saw him stiffen his resolve, closing his eyes and maintaining a statue-like stillness for several minutes. Eventually he exhaled a long, slow breath, sweat shining through the mass of hair that hung over his heavy brow. He rose, his gaze resting on Reva, warm with sympathy and sorrow.
"My lady," he began.
"I know," she told him. "I was there. Master Markin, please tell Lord Alsorna all you saw."
"His early years are confused,"
Markin said to Valen. It appears he was raised in the Church of the World Father. There are no images of his parents, so I judge him an orphan. Apprenticed to a priest, a common fate for Cumbrailian orphans, I believe. The priest who raised him was kind, a former soldier in the Lord's Guard, called to the church in later life, keen for his charges to acquire both his martial abilities and the fierceness of his devotion. The boy spent long years steeped both in study of the 10 books and training for war. In manhood he endured long years of shame when he looked at women. The younger the woman, the greater the shame, and the more he looked. I sensed a compulsion to hide in the 10 books, to find refuge from his desires in the church's teachings. Altor and the cathedral loom large in his memory, and I believe he was sent there in preparation for priesthood. I saw him meet the reader and receive his priestly name. They never met in public, and I sensed the priest had been chosen for a secret role. I saw a journey away from Altor halting when he finds a man with a scar here. Markin paused to touch his cheek. The man is speaking before a large crowd, and the young priest burns with new passion on hearing his voice. He returns to the reader and is sent forth again. Then there are many months of meetings in dark rooms and secluded hollows, men clustering together and fearful of discovery as they pass letters and gather weapons in hidden caches. He never sees the scarred man again, but the memory comes to him often. Then at another hidden meeting he finds this thing. Markin nodded at the second body, grimacing as his gaze touched Brado's dead face. It talks. The words are lost to me, as you know, my lord, but they make his passion burn even brighter. The thing leads him to a farmhouse at night. Inside, an old couple sit before a fire, fussing over a little girl. He looked again at Reva and Swallows. The priest's shame is deeper than ever when he looks at her. They killed my grandparents, didn't they? Reva asked. They killed them and they stole me. He nodded. They waited until you had been put to bed. The old couple were killed, the girl stolen from her bed, the farmhouse burned. And then many happy years in a barn, Reva muttered as Markin fumbled for the right words to say. Any names? Valen asked the gifted. A few, my lord. The priest would write them down to memorize. He would burn the paper, but the memories remain. Make a list, and give it to Lady Reva. She moved back to the priest's corpse, feeling a great temptation to smash her boot into his contented face. Spoil his slumber forever. Reva, Alonis said, tugging at her sleeve. There's nothing more to learn here. Markin stammered. I do have his name, my lady. The reader wrote it down when he gave it to him. No, she said, turning to walk to the tent flap. Burn it if you're done, she told Valen. No words are to be spoken for him. My lord, Markin continued as they made to leave, if I may, about Brother Canis. I am aware of the matter, Master Markin, Valen told him. We didn't follow you here to become servants of the faith. We'll discuss it tonight, Valen told him in a level voice. With Lord Norta. Your concerns are fully noted. They walked in silence back to the causeway, Reva preoccupied with the gifted's tale, Valen no doubt pondering Brother Canis's revelation to the Queen. Alornis followed at a discreet distance, eyes scanning the city walls, and her ever-present leather-bound bundle of sketches clutched to her chest, already filling up with renderings of the destruction behind the walls. She had cried the day she found Reva standing amidst the corpse-littered streets. Upon seeing her, Alornis had thrown her arms around Reva, convulsing with relief, provoking an old ache that Reva found didn't pain her in quite the same way. The Seventh Order, she said to Valen as they halted before the causeway. Not a legend, after all. But I suppose you've known that a while. Yes. His face was somber, not quite so fatigued as it had been recently, but still he seemed to have aged much in a few days. Though there was something I should have known, but didn't. Brother Canis? He nodded and changed the subject. What will you do with the names Markin gives you? Hunt them down, and subject them to trial. If they are proved to be sons, I'll hang them. My lady governess favours harsh justice. They plotted the death of my uncle, with the full contrivance of the church that has compelled the people of this fief to servile respect for centuries. They conspired with foul creatures of the dark to subject me to a lifetime of abuse before sending me after you in the hope I would die. And let's not forget their attempt to kill our queen. Must I go on? He studied her face for a moment, and she felt the harshness of her expression soften under the scrutiny. I am sorry for everything that happened to you here, Reva. If I had had any inkling... I know. She forced a smile. Join us tonight. Velis found a new cook, though we can offer only 2 courses and no wine. I can't. There's much to do. He glanced back at the camp where soldiers were busy packing gear and supplies in preparation for tomorrow's march, and the commencement of what was fast becoming known as the Queen's Crusade. She wanted me to ask, he said, turning back, how many men you will send with us. I'll not be sending any. I'll be leading them. The full house guard plus 500 archers. Reva, you have done enough. Arkan's slack, lifeless face, the sword in his back, the archers flailing in the river as the arrows lashed down, Uncle Centus dying on the cathedral steps. No, she said. No, I haven't. Velis came to her somewhere past midnight. They had reverted to keeping separate rooms in the aftermath of the siege, more at the Lady Counselor's insistence than hers. Their numerous indiscretions might have been overlooked in the storm of daily battle, but the city had begun to resume a strange normality now the corpses and the worst of the rubble had been cleared away, and the cathedral reopened. Are you sure you want to meet them alone? Velis asked. They lay side by side, covered in a faint sheen of sweat, Reva enjoying the feel of the Lady Counselor's unbound hair clinging to her skin. They need to know I speak with my own mind, she replied, given what I have to tell them. They won't like it. I should hope so. She pulled Velis closer, pressing a kiss to her lips to forestall further discussion. Lady Alornis, Velis said a while later. You care for her. She's a friend to me, like her brother. No more than that. Jealous, honored counselor. Trust me, you don't want to see me jealous. She raised herself up, hugging her knees. I was always going to leave, you know, when the war was done, if your uncle had lived. Take the gold he offered and go. Never cared about all the names they called me, or the reader's sneering condescension. But I was getting tired of it all, the lies and the intrigue. Even for a former spy, it can grow wearisome. Reva reached out to stroke her naked back. And now? Now I can't imagine being anywhere else. Reva felt her tense in anticipation of her next words. The Queen's Crusade. Is my crusade, and not a topic for discussion. Do you think she would be so welcoming if she knew your true nature? If she knew about us? Unless it proved an impediment to liberating this realm, I doubt she would care one whit. She recalled her first meeting with the Queen, the fierce intelligence shining through the seared mask of her face, and the implacable determination, the singularity of purpose Reva recognized from infrequent youthful glances at her own reflection. But I was sent in search of a myth, she thought. Her quarry is all too real, and I doubt she'll be satisfied with however many we find at Varenshold. In truth, she confessed to Velis, that woman scares me more than the Valerians ever did. Then why follow her? Because he does. He tells me this is necessary. I once failed to heed his words. I'll not make the same mistake again. He's just a man, Velis murmured, although Reva could hear the uncertainty in her voice. The tale was on every set of lips, Cambrelians as enraptured by it as all the others, flying far and wide with every telling. One man, cutting his way through an army to save a city, and living to tell the tale. Living? Reva remembered how his features had sagged that day, her tears and the pounding rain washing the blood away as she screamed at him to stay with her. But he hadn't. She had seen it plainly. For those few seconds, he had not been in his body. "I'll need you to take care of things while I'm gone," she said. "Rebuild as best you can. I leave Lord Arentes here as surety of my word, though no doubt he'll hate me for it. How about a new title? Vice-governess, maybe. I'm sure you can come up with something better." Velis hugged her legs tighter. "I don't want titles. I just want you." Lords Arentes and Antesh preceded her into the cathedral, striding through the cavernous interior towards the reader's chambers as she followed, with 20 of the house guard at her back. The two priests standing guard at the chamber door were subdued without particular difficulty, Lord Arentes thrusting the doors open and standing aside to allow her entry. Reva paused at the sight of the priest, held to the wall by Lord Antesh, a sallow-faced man with a heavily bandaged hand and misshapen nose. "I never learned your name," she said. The priest scowled and said nothing until Antesh gave him a none too gentle shake.
"My name is for the Father alone,
and I believe he wants you to share it." She beckoned two guards forward. "Take this one to Lady Velis. Tell her I think he would benefit from some herbal medicine." She turned back to the open door as they hustled the priest away, entering at a sedate pace and offering a brisk greeting to the 7 old men she found seated at a circular table. "Good bishops!" There were supposed to be 10, but 3 had perished in the siege, not, she suspected, by virtue of any courageous act. One of the bishops struggled to his feet as she walked to the only empty chair at the table. A wizened and bird-like man she recalled had objected when she gave the cathedral over to the care of the wounded.
"This is the holy conclave of the 10 bishops," he sputtered. "You are not permitted—"
He fell silent as Lord Arentes brought a gauntleted fist down hard on the table.
"The correct form of address for the lady governess," he told the quailing cleric, "is my lady, and no door in this city is barred to her."
Reva paused at the empty chair, naturally the most ornate in the room, with an ample cushion for the old bastard's bony behind. She sighed and pushed it out of her way.
"Can't kill him twice, more's the pity."
"Now, now, my lord commander," she told Arentes, "we should respect the good bishop's privacy. Leave us, for we have much to discuss." They sat in dumb silence as the doors closed with an echoing boom. She waited for it to fade before speaking, all vestige of respect stripped from her tone.
"So have you chosen?"
Only one spoke up, a slight man with a prominent nose, a little younger than his colleagues.
"We had not yet counted the ballots, my lady."
He indicated a plain wooden box in the center of the table.
"Then do so now."
Reva studied him closely as he reached for the box, finding she remembered his face from the day the reader died, one who smiled when she charged the old man. A possible ally? She steeled her thoughts against the suggestion. Markin's revelations left no room for accommodation. "I have no friends in this room."
"The Bishop of the Southern Parish?"
The thin bishop reported after counting the ballots. "By unanimous assent." Reva scanned the faces around the table, finding 6 scared old men and 1 sleeping ancient who hadn't raised his head since her entry.
"Who is?"
she inquired. The thin bishop cleared his throat in discomfort.
"I am, my lady."
She gave a short laugh and turned her back on him, her gaze drawn to a candlelit alcove at the rear of the chamber, where 10 large tomes sat on lecterns. The books were ancient, the bindings flaking and cracked with age. The first to be bound in the land of Cumbrail, she knew, finding it odd that she felt no upswelling of awe at the sight. Just a collection of old books in a room of old men.
"I have in my possession," she said, turning back to the table, "what I believe to be a complete list of adherents to the heretical sect known as the Sons of the True Blade. In due course, each and every name on this list will be captured and put to the question. I am sure you will join me in rejoicing at this news,
given the wealth of intelligence they are sure to provide. She scanned each face in turn, finding confusion on most, but fear on others.